On the latest episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Ava Orsmond, chatting all things life lessons.
People often say to me when they come to my clinics, and now especially when they come to the hotel, they are like, you know, Ava, you are not the persona you the TV have, you know, made you to be. And actually, sometimes I'm thinking, my God, that's terribly sad that there is that negative. There's some people who absolutely don't like me because what they saw on television.
As ever, it's available on all podcast platforms.
Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
So he goes back a better player from this experience, and he'll have a few extra quid in his pocket, so, and possibly a medal in his pocket. It's a great move for him. It's good for Leinster in some ways, but in other ways, and I think I'm more leaning this way, I don't like it for Leinster either. I think the homegrown talent that they have, I really feel like they might curtail some of these things.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you like the Indo Daily, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just a warning that this podcast contains graphic descriptions of extreme violence that some people may find upsetting.
Davidson County 911, what is the address of your emergency?
Limerick man Jason Corbett and his wife Molly Martins appeared to be living the all-American dream in North Carolina. But then came the nightmare for the Corbett family of August 2nd, 2015.
My name is Tom Martins. I'm at 160 Panther Creek Court. My daughter's husband, my son-in-law, got in a fight with my daughter. I intervened, and I think he's in bad shape.
Okay, what do you mean he's in bad shape? He's hurt?
He's bleeding all over, and I may have killed him.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, we go to the North Carolina courtroom where Molly and Tom Martins have been sent for a retrial for the murder of Jason Corbett. Ralph, tell us about Molly Martins' background, and then how did she come to meet Jason Corbett?
Yeah, Molly Martins was the daughter of Tom Martins, who at the time was a serving FBI agent. She was born in Knoxville in Tennessee, was very much, I mean, in her younger years, was you could very much describe her as like the all-American girl. She was involved in lots of sporting activities. It was hoped that she would go to one of the top U.S. colleges. Unfortunately, in her latter teens, things really went off the rails a little bit. There seemed to be mental health problems developed. She suffered a lot from depression. She did go to university, but she dropped out after a year. And while very few people, I think, outside the immediate family knew it, she began to retreat at times into almost an imaginary world. And she found it easier, apparently, to deal with the challenges of life by simply making up stories, almost like a Walter Mitty type thing. And in a way, that's what kind of led her to meet the fateful meeting with Jason Corbett. Molly struggled to hold down a series of jobs, and she was just coming out of a very, very bad bout of depression. She was engaged at the time to a very, very nice man who worked in the aviation industry, a guy called Keith McGinn. She was coming out of this depression and suddenly hit on this idea that she'd be much happier if she was looking after children. She loved children, and she thought, if I was a nanny or something like that, I'd be much happier. And really, without telling him, she started looking for ads to see where were there opportunities to work as a nanny. Now, bear in mind, she had no qualifications, and unfortunately, she struck upon an ad that had been put in a newspaper by Jason Corbett, who had very tragically lost his first wife, Margaret Mags Fitzpatrick, to a freak asthma attack in November 2006. And Mags died when her daughter, Sarah, was literally just 7 weeks old, and Jason was left with two children, both aged under 2 years, Jack, his son, and Sarah, his daughter, trying to look after them. And that's when he went looking for a nanny, and for a fateful moment, Molly Martins entered their lives.
And Jason's background then, obviously his life changed dramatically with the passing of his wife, but quite a successful executive in his own right.
For Jason, everything he really had to work very hard for. Now, he was from a very, very tight-knit family in Limerick. He was brought up. He didn't go to third level. He went straight into a factory job. But I think it's a measure of the man that he wasn't content to just do a factory job for the rest of his life. He went in, he did training courses, he went to night school, he did lots of things to try and improve himself, and gradually was promoted right up the ranks of the company he worked for, which was in the whole packaging sector. He met, fell in love with Mags Fitzpatrick. It was very much a love match. They got married, they built a house just on the outskirts of Limerick, and everything seemed golden for the couple, unfortunately, until that November evening when Mags was at home. Mags' sister was staying with Jason and Mags at the time, and Mags had gone to bed, and Jason was just about to go to bed finishing the washing up, and Mags alerted her sister and her husband that she was getting an asthma attack. Unfortunately, unlike previous asthma attacks, this one couldn't be controlled. And Jason, in desperation, put her in his car, drove to try and meet the ambulance, which was coming from University Hospital Limerick. And his wife stopped breathing in the car. He had to pull the car to the side of the road. He did emergency CPR. He got her to the paramedics. He managed to get her back breathing. The paramedics were working on her. Unfortunately, she stopped breathing in the ambulance en route to University Hospital Limerick. They couldn't save her, so she died, and it really shattered his world. His family rallied around, but I think a measure of his recovery was that after about 6 months to 12 months, he decided that it was time he got more independent in his life, and that he wasn't entirely dependent on childminding duties on his family. So he decided to get an au pair or a nanny. That's when he put the ad in for a long-term nanny, and that's when he met Molly Martins.
And from there then, effectively, Jason Corbett, a second life was rebuilt effectively around Molly.
Yes, very, very quickly, Molly became an integral part of this small family. And Jason's own family initially were very supportive of her. They were very glad to see that he was happy. They felt that Molly looked after the children very well, that she was, at some times, they thought that she was overly dependent on the children, that Molly would prefer the company of the children almost than to other adults. But over time, I think they became quite concerned, because they realized that Molly, it wasn't just an employer-employee relationship, that there was a romantic relationship had very quickly developed between Molly and between Jason. Now, I think it's worth pointing out that Molly at this stage was in her mid-20s. She was a very, very attractive girl. She had flowing blonde hair, quite a vivacious personality. When she chose to, she could, you know, enchant everyone in her company. But there were other times where she was aloof, where she really didn't want to get involved with any of Jason's friends. And she was happiest when she was left alone with Jack and Sarah. The relationship was a little rocky at times. There was a period where Molly went back to the United States. And some of the emails which I've seen, I've had access to over the years, the emails that Molly has sent to Jason are very much pleading in nature, urging him not to give up on love, urging him to commit to the relationship, saying that she wants to, you know, him to move the relationship on to another level. And you can understand the confusion of this young father of two. You know, he's not sure, should he go ahead with the relationship? It's moving very fast. A lot of the letters that Jason had sent to Molly at this time were pleading for the relationship to continue at a much slower pace. But that's not what Molly wanted. And eventually, Molly returned to Ireland. The relationship accelerated. They got engaged. At this point, Molly said she wasn't happy living in the house that Jason had effectively built for Mags, his first wife. So that house was sold. They relocated to a housing estate in Raheen in Limerick. And then Molly started saying that she was very homesick, that she wanted to go back to the United States, and that in the United States, Jack and Sarah would have a much better quality of life. And Jason eventually agreed that they would do that. And in June 2011, at a lavish ceremony, which was entirely paid for by Jason Corbett, Jason and Molly married at a former Confederate plantation in south of Knoxville in Tennessee.
They moved to the United States. They lived that, as you describe it, all-American life with the big house, the two cars in the driveway, the barbecues and the soccer and baseball for the kids and so on. Can you take me then to August 1st of 2015? How had Jason spent that day and what subsequently emerged?
By August of 2015, there were problems. They had all of the trappings of a happy life, but behind the front door, things were far from happy. Jason's family maintained that he was being subjected to gaslighting, and essentially that is efforts by one person to undermine and demean the other person to the point where their confidence and their self-belief is shaken. And it's interesting to note that just a couple of weeks after Jason and Molly married at Bleak House, this Confederate plantation in South Tennessee, Molly went to a divorce lawyer. And it's a strange thing that anyone would do immediately after getting married, that they would go to a divorce lawyer. But Molly's query was, what rights did she have to Jack and Sarah? And it was pointed out to her that because she wasn't their birth mother, she was the second wife, Jason was a widower, Jason had in the entire rights to the two children. Molly had the right to 50% of the marital property, as is the law in North Carolina, but the children remained in the custody and care of her husband in the event of any marriage breakdown. Now, the Martins family, including Tom Martins, had repeatedly asked Jason to sign effectively adoption papers that would give Molly equal rights to the two children. But for whatever reason, I think by this stage, Jason had become increasingly concerned about his wife's mental health and her increasingly bizarre behavior. And he decided he wasn't going to sign those papers. Now, 24 hours before August the 1st, there was an incident at a local party. There's a tradition here. They call it a cornhole party, which is a little bit like a kind of a build up to the harvest where an entire community gets together, a housing estate might get together. They have a barbecue. People, every household brings their own little food offering and they play a series of traditional games. And at that party, Molly subjected Jason to pretty horrific verbal abuse. She challenged him about his weight. She challenged him about the type of person he was and really humiliated him in front of all of the neighbors. And it's quite poignant that Jason left the party on his own. He went back to the house and he put his last post on social media. He went onto Facebook and he said, you know, why is it that people will believe the worst things that are said about you without a second thought, but they have to be persuaded to believe the good things about you? And that was the last posting that he ever did on social media. The following day, Jason was cutting the lawn. A neighbor was doing the same. They took several breaks while they were cutting the lawn. They had a couple of beers. When they had finished their work, they went into a shaded area on deck chairs. They had a couple of more beers. Molly joined them. And quite surprisingly, in the afternoon, Molly's parents arrived. And why that was surprising is that they lived in Knoxville in Tennessee, which is almost a 6-hour drive from where Jason and Molly were living at Wahlberg, just outside Winston-Salem. And this trip was entirely unplanned. It was a spur of the moment trip. And during the 2017 trial, we had heard that there were multiple calls, more than a dozen calls made by Molly to her parents during that trip. And when the parents arrived, Jason got up, he walked over to their car, he took their suitcases out of the boot of the car, brought them into the house for the couple. And those who witnessed the scene said it seemed to be very friendly, very amicable. A son-in-law greeting his mother and father-in-law in the normal fashion. And that was on the evening. There was a pizza bought for dinner. And then suddenly in the early hours of the morning, all hell broke loose. Neighbors awoke to see police cars, ambulances at the scene. Inside the house, it was a scene of carnage. Jason was found naked on the floor of his bedroom on his back. He had been subjected to a savage beating. He had been struck with a metal Louisville Slugger baseball bat. He was struck with a concrete paving slab. He was beaten about the head so many times that a pathologist, Dr. Craig Nelson, told the 2017 hearing that he couldn't accurately count the number of blows that were inflicted. And in quite horrific detail, the pathologist said that when Jason's body was being lifted onto the slab in the hospital for the post-mortem examination, pieces of his skull were actually falling out of his head. Molly and Tom were at the scene. They were both uninjured. There wasn't a scratch, a bruise, a cut on either of the two, but both insisted they had acted entirely in self-defense. They claimed that Jason had attacked his wife in the early hours of the morning, that Tom had heard the noise upstairs. He grabbed the metal Louisville Slugger baseball bat, which he had brought. It belonged to one of his own sons, who were now adults, and he had brought the baseball bat all the way from Knoxville to Jason Corbett's house as a present for young Jack. He said that because Jack was out playing with his friends, he didn't get a chance to give the present to him that evening. And it was in the bedroom when he heard the disturbance upstairs. He grabbed the metal baseball bat, ran upstairs, and he claimed that Jason was holding Molly by the neck. Obviously, a violent interaction began at that stage, which ended with Jason being horrifically beaten. His blood was all over the bedroom. His blood was in the hallway. His blood was in the bathroom. His blood was even splattered on parts of the stairs. The emergency services were notified. What was interesting, there were several key factors emerged that very quickly turned this from a case of potential domestic violence into a case of second-degree murder. The paramedics that arrived at the scene noted that Jason Corbett's body was cold to the touch. That would not be the case if they were notified immediately after the assault. And the conclusion was that Tom and Molly had waited for some considerable period of time before alerting the emergency services to ensure that Jason was dead. A subsequent blood spatter analysis of the scene indicated that Jason was lying in bed when the first blow was struck, that he was lying on the floor, helpless, when he was also beaten, and that at least one of the blows that were aimed at his head was struck after he was already dead. Outside, Molly was wearing a kind of a fur coat and blue patterned pajamas. Two different police officers had to approach Molly and tell her to stop rubbing her neck. They had noticed that she was vigorously rubbing her neck. Both police officers had to go and ask her to stop doing that. Both Tom and Molly were taken to the police station where they made statements, and both were adamant that they had acted entirely in self-defense, despite the fact that there was no mark, no bruise, no scratch on either of the two of them, despite the fact that, according to their own story, they were just involved in this desperate life and death struggle with an Irishman who weighed about 17 to 18 stone and would have been very, very strong.
Can you take us through just the legal proceedings then that have taken place? So we had a trial. When was that, and how long did it last?
Okay, so Jason's body was found. It was recovered from the property in August of 2015. Within a couple of weeks, the investigation switched from a potential domestic violence dispute to a second degree murder investigation. In 2016, Tom and Molly Martins were charged with second-degree murder. In June of 2017, there was a pre-trial hearing in advance of a full murder trial at Davidson County Superior Court. And that murder trial opened in July of 2017, where there was a total of 23 different witnesses over almost 4 weeks. And really what the case hinged on, and the case was before Judge David Lee, and it hinged on forensic evidence. It hinged on the interpretation of the blood spatter evidence, which indicated that, far contrary to what Tom and Molly were saying, that Jason was in bed when the first blow was struck, that he was lying helpless on the ground when he was struck again, and that he was struck even after he was dead. The fact that he was cold to the touch when the paramedics arrived, which indicated that there had been a deliberate delay in notifying them about the incident. And even more bizarrely, it emerged during the trial that a toxicological analysis of Jason's blood had revealed traces of trazodone, which was a sedative. And what's interesting about it is that Jason Corbett was not prescribed trazodone, but trazodone was given to his wife Molly just 4 to 5 days before he was beaten to death. I remember when the jury were sent out, all of the reporters in court thought that it could be 3 or 4 days given the length of the trial and the amount of evidence, but the jury were actually back just a couple of hours later with the unanimous conviction. Tom and Molly were immediately taken into custody. They were let out of the courtroom, and the prosecutor stood up and said they were ready to go to sentencing straight away. The defence had no objection, and they were sentenced literally within, I'd say, 45 minutes both received the guideline sentence, which was 20 to 25 years in prison for a second degree murder conviction. Outside the court, Michael Ernest, who is the brother-in-law of Tom Martin's and Molly's uncle, he described the conviction as a travesty of justice. And he said that he confirmed that there would be a full appeal launched immediately. So that appeal process took time. The Court of Appeal, by a 2-1 margin, had ruled in favour of Tom and Molly Martin's and effectively recommended the overturning of the conviction. That was challenged by the district attorney, the attorney general here in North Carolina, and it went to the North Carolina Supreme Court, where in March of last year, so that's March of 2021, the North Carolina Supreme Court ruled that the conviction should be overturned. Essentially, that was the end of it from the state's point of view. They had to make a decision either to allow Molly and Tom to walk free or to make the decision to go for a retrial. And towards the tail end of last year, it was confirmed that a retrial would take place. And then, of course, we had a hearing last Wednesday, which was September the 21st, where Judge David Hall confirmed that the full retrial will take place on June the 26th of 2023. That is 8 years after Jason was killed and 6 years after the original trial.
And the reaction then of the Corbett family to court proceedings this week?
Publicly, there has been none. Judge Hall last March issued quite a strict gagging order, and he warned that he did not want any extrajudicial comments made by any member of the prosecution or the defense teams or any of their agents. Now, the judge reminded everyone of that on Wednesday, and he went further to say that in his view, there were people that had ignored that order. And he went so far as to say that if there was any continuation of such extrajudicial comments, no matter how innocuous they might be, he said he would move to a contempt hearing. So I would certainly say that between now and June the 26th, no one associated with the case in any shape or form is going to say anything publicly. They were hoping that the retrial would take place in June, July and August of this year. Then they had hoped that it would happen in October or November before Christmas. And now they're left waiting for another 10 months before it takes place. And I think their primary concern is the welfare of Jason's two children, Jack and Sarah. Jack is currently sitting his leaving cert. Sarah is awaiting her junior cert results. And the family have made the point repeatedly over the last couple of months that these two children have lived virtually half of their lives under the shadow of a murder investigation, a murder trial, appeals against a murder conviction, and now the prospect of a full murder retrial. And they said it's just not fair for the children that while they're coming into such a crucial period of their life in terms of academic examinations, that they should have the shadow of this case hanging over them.
My thanks to Ralph Regal for joining me today from North Carolina. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Garrett Mulhall, researched by Tabitha Monaghan, with sound by John Smith. Archive clips from ABC and independent.ie. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow and leave us a review.